Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 144 on Russell's Dinosauroid with Dr. Will Tattersdale of the University of Birmingham. So, this is a very special episode for me. And my cat, not least because it's an incredibly engaging interview, but because this release also marks my 10 years at the helm of PaleoCast. I'm so proud of what the show has become, and thank you all for joining me along in this journey. So, from one of the oldest paleontology podcasts to the newest, in this week's Paleo Podcast Plug, we're introducing you to the freshly made Paleo Jam.
I'm Michael Mills, and I'm the host of Paleo Jam, a podcast exploring a range of issues in science and the community through the lens of paleontology. Paleo Jam is not just about fossils and what they tell us about the past. We want to get to know the insights and opinions of paleontologists on a whole range of issues. We also want to give opportunities to those working or studying paleos who don't often or never speak in public to be heard. Now, it's an Australian-produced paleo podcast, and each episode has a broad theme that's covered within a strict 30-minute time frame. We have a countdown clock present as we're recording, and there's no editing allowed. I want it to always have a live feel, even if we don't have a live audience. As with any podcast, we also expect it to evolve as it develops from series to series, and look forward to however the adventure unfolds.
It's time to spread some paleo jam!
So today's interviewee, Will, is from the Department of English Literature at the University of Birmingham. He researches the social history of dinosaurs from the 1800s to the present day. So he's able to offer us unique insights into what is clearly a very interesting subject. We're all going to have our own opinions of the dinosauroid. So I want to hear yours. What do you think about it? As a concept, what do you think about it as a physical model? Is it some of the best or the worst paleo art that's ever been made? And has your opinion of it changed after listening to this interview? And as always, images to accompany this episode are available on our website, and likes, comments, shares, and especially 5-star reviews on iTunes would all make fantastic 10th birthday presents for the show. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Will. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Right. We always like to get to know our interviewees first, and we always like to see how you ended up interested in paleontology and in the position that you're in now. So, yeah, where did it all begin for you?
Sure. So I guess the most important thing to know about me is that I'm not a paleontologist at all. I am actually a literary critic. So I study the history of science fiction in particular. And I got interested in dinosaurs because I was writing a book about kind of early-ish science fiction of the 1890s, 1900s. And very much my perspective as a literary critic on that kind of writing is that we do down both literature and science when we keep insisting on, you know, this idea that they never talk to each other, that there's a left brain and a right brain, and that you can't be interested in or knowledgeable about one, about both at the same time, rather. So I'm always interested in ways of questioning this idea that science and art are separate and can't ever talk to each other. And while I was researching that book, I came across a few stories about the age of reptiles. And I was thinking, you know, dinosaurs are an absolutely amazing way of making this point about science and art, because you can't have a dinosaur without science and art. You need, and history teaches us this, you need a very firm scientific establishment, a very precise sense of the history of deep time, an ability to understand and process fossils and communicate the results, things that you don't get until the 1820s, 30s. But you also need people who can visualize it and a cultural imagination that can handle the idea of this other world that existed before ours. And so I came to it very naturally because I was trying to think about, okay, where is it that we see science and art really working together and not being enemies? And dinosaurs are a place where that happens all the time.
Okay, so what do you mean that we can't have them without art? I can literally go into the field and dig up a dinosaur and there it is.
You can, but to imagine it as it was and the world that it lived in, there is still imagination there, I think. Even for the most technically minded person. And the best way to put that stuff back together, even if you're not, as many of the early paleontologists did, having recourse to the imaginative potential of, for example, the Bible, to put that world together, it requires you to have a kind of literacy in these movements of the fantastic imagination, I suppose. So it's sort of, this is always the point where it gets, I suppose, a little bit awkward because scientists think that I'm saying you're making it all up, which is absolutely not what I'm saying at all. It's just that idea of lyrically seeing the past in the way that makes the dinosaur so successful and so powerful as an idea in popular culture is something that requires artistic as well as scientific preparation. And, you know, there's proof of that out there because people were turning over dinosaur bones in fields for centuries before putting them together, you know, as dinosaurs. And it's only when you get the kind of scientific and cultural structures of the early Victorian period hammering away at it that you start to get the dinosaur in its modern sense.
There is so much there that we could talk about for episodes upon episodes,
I'm sure there is.
I mean, do you as a researcher find that this area is incredibly rich of questions for you to study? I mean, are you actively still working on paleontology and the arts?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And look, it's an interesting one because you talk to scientists and say, you know, have you thought about the arts? But you also have to talk to other literary critics who are not paying much attention on the whole to science. There are a good number of us thinking about scientific questions, but compared to the total of people studying literature, it's a small number. But even within that, then, though the subject is growing, it's still a bit of a strange thing to be doing as a literary critic. So I think it's this middle ground where from both angles you're a little bit people are a little bit baffled. I would say. Because people ask me sometimes on both sides, do you get hostility from scientists or from other literary critics? And I would say very little hostility, but quite a lot of confusion. People are like, why are you doing this? but for me, there's tons and tons in there. The surface hasn't been scratched of the subject, really. W.J.T. Mitchell wrote a book in 1998 called The Last Dinosaur Book, which was his attempt to kind of draw a line under the idea of the dinosaur as a cultural artifact. And, you know, it's hilarious now because he didn't even start, obviously. Tons to do.
Good. So in this episode, we're going to be looking at an intersection of, okay, science fiction, art,
yeah,
speculation. There's a whole load of stuff that's wrapped up in this. And it all starts perhaps with Dale Russell. Yes. So who was he? What was his background? And yeah, just give us an introduction to him.
So Russell, who passed away relatively recently, was a Canadian vertebrate paleontologist. Born in America, worked in Canada for most of his career. Was really one of the foremost people in Canada for dinosaurs in the 1970s, 80s. Other people are much more qualified than I to kind of talk through his resume. I understand his importance to the field as being primarily connected with encephalization and kind of understanding dinosaur intelligence, but he did loads of other things. I know he worked a lot on mosasaurs. I believe he did. For our purposes today, he worked on troodontids, of course. And so this is his idea, which has taken on a life of its own, really, that if you got this one particular troodontid, Stenonicosaurus, and allowed it to survive the KPG mass extinction, that it would have evolved into something bipedal and intelligent and quite human-like in appearance. And this idea was not one that Russell spent most of his career on, but it's probably the thing he's most known for now because it's so ludicrous and so wonderful.
Yep. My first thought as a paleontology student when I saw this was that it was incredibly ludicrous, and it was a subject of quite merciless mocking. Like, how could anyone think that was a good idea, or what were they trying to do? Like, how could you get it so so if anyone's not familiar with this dinosauroid, then we've got pictures on our website. Please check it out. It is something that you need to be able to see and make your own opinions of as well. So what was he trying to achieve with it, I guess?
You know, it's such an interesting question. I want to ask you something before I try and answer that. When you said kind of your first reaction was, why would anyone do this?
Yeah.
What do you mean by this? Is it the idea that it exists at all? Is it the idea that it's posited as a serious hypothesis? Is it the seriousness that's the problem?
It would have been the seriousness that it was presented, that how can you make any sort of speculation about what a hypothetical scenario, how that could have ended up, and just the way that it ended up looking like it did as well. I just found it so crazy that you could wind the clock 65 million years into the future and come up with anything for certain, or, you know, that especially. So
I mean, as you know, and you already kind of said this when you introduced the subject, but we, you know, there's a real hornet's nest here, and there's several different metaphysical problems kind of jockeying for our attention. But one of them is like this really fundamental idea of how can we know what would have happened, you know? And in that sense, it goes into something else within the history of science fiction that I've researched a little bit, which is alternate history. So stuff like, you know, like The Man in the High Castle, which is a sort of what if the Nazis won the Second World War, that kind of stuff. And that has its origins, that kind of writing, in sort of historical essays, particularly French ones written in the 19th century. What if Napoleon had won at Waterloo? How would history have proceeded differently? And what's interesting is that even questions like that, which, you know, compared to evolution going differently, these are really tiny questions, right? But even these are regarded by practicing historians as being very dangerous, because immediately you remove yourself from the realm of provable evidence. And so you can say, well, if Napoleon won, you know, X, Y, and Z would have happened. But all you can ever do is make that assertion. There's no question of proving it. So in one sense, the whole enterprise is really muddy. And that's before we introduce, you know, 65 extra million years of historical uncertainty into the question. But on the other hand, this is a kind of thinking that we all do every day. Oh, if I'd only got that bus instead of that one, then I wouldn't have missed this thing and blah, blah, blah. This would have got different. What if I'd been offered this job? What if I'd met this person instead of this one? You know, this is a normal way that we think all the time. And so in another sense, I think Russell is just indulging that on a grand scale. And he is having fun with it. He emphasizes in the original publication, he does emphasize that it's tenuous. You know, he doesn't say, I'm certain this is what it would have looked like. He frames it as a kind of conversation starter, which it definitely was. But he also uses the word entertaining to describe it. So it's this odd thing about Russell, and I think it's very much his personality from what I've been able to learn about him, is that on the one hand, he is kind of having fun, and he sees this as a bit of a holiday. And on the other hand, he is serious about it. And he is philosophically minded. He is interested in these big questions of causality and destiny and religion. And they very much shaped his private life as well as his scientific life. And so you end up with this impossible situation where, on the one hand, you know, to any student of paleontology looking at it today, and at the time, you're like, is this a joke? And the answer to that is kind of, yeah, but also no, but also yes. I'm just talking about a lot of different things at the same time, but that's what the dinosauroid is, right? You end up talking about all kinds of different things. And that's I think, what Russell wanted.
Yeah, and honestly, looking at it as I did and just thinking, just straight up, that's ridiculous, to what I've now come to learn from reading your paper, and it's a whole lot more complicated than I originally thought, and there are different avenues in which we can think about it that, yeah, I just wasn't open to, but now I find it absolutely fascinating. So you've said that it's not super serious, it's also not a joke. So where and how was it published, released, showcased? How was it delivered? Yeah.
Oh, this is an amazing, this is amazing. I'm afraid it's another complicated answer. So yeah, you're so right. It's not serious, and it's also not serious. And that comes across brilliantly in the publication history of the idea. So so it's built at a museum at what is now the Canadian Museum of Nature, which is where Russell works. It's a collaboration between Russell and a sculptor named Ron Segain, who's co-author on the paper. And they are restoring. I always get this wrong. You're going to have to edit this. They are reconstructing a Stenonicosaurus. And doing, as far as I understand from paleontological colleagues, a relatively decent job of it. And somewhere along the way, they start doing these kind of hypothetical evolutions on the model that they're making. So they've got this real dinosaur that they are making a life model of. And they start kind of imagining, okay, how would this respond to evolutionary pressure? And you know, again, if it's a joke, it's a weird one, because they spend a very long time on it, and they do it very carefully. So they make the skull, for example, before anything else. And the reason for that is that encephalization is kind of Russell's thing, and he wants to know how clever it would be to kind of drive everything else. So they're making skulls and kind of all other little bits of it before they eventually kind of put it together as a model that kind of now is kind of usually seen paired with the Stenonicosaurus model. This fascinates me, right? Because it doesn't start life as a sketch or as a paragraph, as a piece of writing. It's a model, and it's specifically a museum model. So it already exists within that space of the museum, which is simultaneously kind of licenses it and gives it a kind of air of hypothesis at the same time. When it actually hits print, it does so in two very different places at almost the same time. The first is Sologius, which is the internal organ of the Canadian Museum of Nature. It is a scientific publication. It is not rigorously peer-reviewed, but it is edited and judged, felt to be a science publication, and it is phrased and framed as one. It's a technical paper. And the interesting thing is it's about the Stenonicosaurus model, and it doesn't mention the dinosauroid apart from the abstract until about halfway through, when it suddenly turns left, I suppose, and starts being about the dinosauroid. Because of the way these papers are circulated in the early 1980s, so this is 1982 that we're in at the moment, many even scientists would have seen the other publication first, which was Omni. Now, Omni is a science fiction / science fact kind of cult magazine that was publishing kind of technology stories, but also outright fiction kind of simultaneously. So there's a piece by Jeff Hecht in there called Smart Dinosaurs, with a big kind of fold-out page with the kind of intelligent eyes of the dinosauroid staring out at you, the viewer.
Wow.
And it obviously frames the thing very differently if you read it in that sort of space than if you read it in the kind of dry technical pages of Syllogius. So this is something that obviously Russell's idea is criticized for, is that, you know, immediately it's going out to the sci-fi crowd, it's going out to kind of cult people and the crazies, even before the scientific publication has had time to get anywhere. But actually, it's a really fitting way of understanding the dinosauroid, because you realize, okay, this is something that makes its emergence as a hypothesis and as a fantasy at exactly the same time, and in a way that's kind of very integrated.
Okay, is there anything that you, as an English literature researcher, that you can spot in the language that reveals the author's attitudes to both publications?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, yeah. So Russell doesn't write the piece in Omni. But he and Sagain are the authors of the technical paper in Syllogius. And this is another kind of frontier in literary criticism, right? We don't normally try and close read scientific papers, scientific nonfiction. In a way, it's a literary form that is designed to resist close reading, because the idea of that kind of incredibly pared down, depersonalized tone is to resist any possibility of subjectivity, right? Is to kind of make sure that there's only one meaning that comes across very clearly, and that there isn't room for kind of that there isn't room for experimentation or play or metaphor or innuendo or anything like that. Now, as a literary critic, I'm afraid to say it doesn't work. There's always wobbliness in language, and you can absolutely find it if you go looking for it here. So one bit that we focused on, Darren Nash and I, when we wrote about this in the Canadian Journal of Earth Sciences recently, there's a bit in the paper where it says it would be fascinating to learn how the saur ornithoid, that's what Russell is calling this group of dinosaurs at the moment, how these attributes of large brain size, stereoscopic vision, opposable fingers, and bipedal stature changed, if at all, during the remainder of Mesozoic time. So he's thinking about the Stenonicosaurus there. And then they say, it might also be entertaining, that's that word, to speculate in a qualitative manner on how the descendants of Stenonicosaurus inequalis might have appeared had they survived the terminal Mesozoic extinctions and achieved an encephalization quotient similar to that of Homo sapiens. And if you read that with a kind of literary critic brain on, what's fascinating there is the provisionality of the language, right? So it starts, it would be fascinating, and then it goes on, it might also be entertaining. And I'm thinking, might also be, but you've actually done this, you know, you've spent months on it, you're writing it up. So it's not that it might also be entertaining, you know, you're there. There's that hesitancy on it. There's that reluctance to kind of completely jump into the idea. We're just saying, you know, this isn't the same as the kind of fact I'm going to declare about about deep time and the Mesozoic past, but it might also be worth mentioning, you know, and then it's the whole second half of the paper. And the other thing from that bit I just read out that really gets me is speculate in a qualitative manner, which I just think is a phrase that's doing an astonishing amount of heavy lifting in this context. How do you speculate in a qualitative manner? But then faced with this kind of philosophical question, what else can you do but speculate in as qualitative a manner as you can? And this is, you know, the lead up, obviously, to Dougal Dixon's more famous work on speculative evolution and so on and so forth. So I think, yeah, I mean, possibly that's more close reading than your listeners would like at this time, whatever time of day they're listening to this. But I was really thrilled that the Canadian Journal of Earth Sciences let me have a few of these moments where we're actually thinking about, okay, how is a scientist kind of making this language work for them in this moment? And I think this is a really key moment where Russell and Sagan are kind of going, you know, if it's okay with you, then we'd like to do this really complicated thing that will take the next 10 pages, you know, and just kind of ease it out there.
No, but I think it's wonderful to be able to look back at our fields that we're all interested in, and speaking for all the listeners, and just look at it with a fresh set of eyes and see things in there that we might not have done so otherwise. I think it's really wonderful that we can do this.
Well, I mean, I hope so. I always feel, again, I've been to meetings with paleontologists who are very confused, and I think the worry with close reading from the scientific perspective is that it feels like a trap, right? It feels like anything you say is going to get jumped on, and that is what it is. But actually, you know, it's an amazingly powerful tool in some ways, and it's good for seeing things from a different angle, for sure.
Yeah. So I want to get back again to why a model was needed at all. Like,
yeah,
surely a picture, surely just a description. Like, if I said to you, what do you think a saber-toothed cat could have looked like if had it not gone extinct? How would it fit into today's ecosystems? That's enough to set people thinking. Like, why did it need this physical model that took time and effort and an article that described it all? And
yeah, it's such a good question. There are a few different possible answers. Mine is because it's museum work. I think it's because they're both museum employees at this point. And it comes out naturally of the work that they're doing reconstructing this Stenonicosaurus. And I think that matters, right? It's an artistic collaboration that is then organically generating new stuff. But I also think, you know, museums are spaces where objects are important, aren't they? And there's something about building something and it being tangible in the museum space, where it's then displayed. And it goes on tour, I should say. It's in the Dinosaurs Past and Present exhibition. So it tours with a lot of famous paleo art in the late 1980s, 1990s. This is an exhibition that comes, for example, to the Natural History Museum in London, but also most of the big North American natural history museums have it. And it goes around with all the other art. Most of it is flat art rather than models, although there are other models in there. But, you know, Greg Paul, Ellie Kish, all of these kinds of people. Which is also fascinating from my perspective, right? Because that's an art exhibition, that's a touring exhibition with absolutely no fossils in it. But it's this new view of dinosaurs, which is going around, and Russell kind of gets to be the punchline. It's always at the end. This is something that we noticed, Darren and I, while we were writing this article. When people mention the dinosaur, it's nearly always at the end. It's at the end of the documentary, or the last chapter of the book, or the afterword. I think that's so telling that people just get to the point where they've made you trust them with how much they know and how much evidence they have. And then they say, oh, you know, and then there's this idea of what could have been. It's not something you can dwell on without losing your credibility, but everyone sort of wants to leave it hanging, wants to leave it in the air, which is the opposite of being a model. So I think its tangibility is really interesting. And I think it's to do with the ability of the museum to underwrite the hypothesis, and I think it's because other dinosaur hypotheses are very tangible things. They're in large cavernous buildings that you enter and are impressed by.
There's a lot of questions that I want to ask about art, but I don't feel like they are particularly good questions. I don't know if they are good questions.
Well, I mean, go on. You can always cut it out.
Okay, so we have this model touring as art, but is it any less serious or less worthwhile than any of the other art that's in that exhibition?
I don't think so. I mean, those are interesting words, serious and worthwhile, right? So we can say that we could talk about it being less accurate, less valid as a hypothesis scientifically. But you know, it's actually a great way of thinking about it, because you look back at the dinosaur art from that period, late 80s, early 90s. Think about what we know now that we didn't then, and you know. There are things missing there as well, right? The science has moved on. And even the most scrupulous dinosaur art from that period, and of course there was a lot that wasn't, is outdated in some way. So as soon as your razor stops being accuracy, then the question becomes, is it informed by the knowledge, the life knowledge of a scientist at the top of his game? Absolutely it is. Is it done sincerely? Yep. Does it immediately evoke very powerful questions in whoever's looking at it, which I think is a reasonable thing to ask of a potential artwork? And it absolutely does. You can't get away from that. I think serious and worthwhile. Absolutely. Now, is it right? That is unanswerable. Is it real science? That's not for me to say. But the consensus appears to be that it isn't.
I am flip-flopping between it's the worst piece of paleo art and it's the greatest piece of paleo art that's ever existed. And I don't know what to feel about it.
What are the arguments both ways? Why is it the greatest, do you think?
Because we're talking about it 40 years later.
Yeah.
Like, we've got a whole episode. I'm fascinated. I want to know everything about it. Why did it come to be? What is it saying? How accurate is it? There's just... I've got a whole list of questions that I'm literally asking you today. And then the opposite side of it is still my paleontological side, where I just say, like, there are just so many variables that could come into it that it's just, you're going to be so wrong that is it even worth ever trying to seriously come up with a hypothesis and model that? But then that's not the point of art. So I'm back again to it's brilliant.
I completely understand where you're coming from, because I came across this, you know, it's something people mention. If you read books about dinosaur reconstruction, it comes up, you know. And nobody's very few people, sorry, are arguing for it seriously. But everybody mentions it still, you know? So, you know, Jonathan Lossos in Impossible Destinies recently, about 5 years old, that book now, that history of the kind of the contretemps between Stephen Jay Gould and Simon Conway Morris about contingency and kind of whether evolution is inevitable or follows an inevitable route. And the dinosaur is in the introduction and conclusion of that book, even it sort of frames the debate. People can't stop talking about it. And it pops up in the media all the time still.
I wasn't aware.
Oh yeah, for sure. So a few years ago when we just started writing about it, the Daily Star of all places did a piece about how dinosaurs could have made civilization if the asteroid hadn't wiped them out, which is a very very bad way of understanding even Russell's original paper, but that was 2019, making headlines. And it's in their weird news category, right? And I read it, and I was like, this isn't news. This is 1982. What are you doing?
Whilst you were sat there reading the Daily Star, did you just happen upon it?
You know, when people find out that you do the kind of thing I do, people just start sending you stuff, and you just have to accept it. You just get links all the time from well-meaning people. If any of those people are listening to this, please keep sending them. I love it. But you do end up on some strange website sometimes. The thing is, and going back a little bit to your question about kind of the value of this thing, is that Russell and Seguin kind of expressly say at the end of their paper that what they want to do is invite contributions to the discussion. And, you know, there have been kind of a few replies to the dinosauroid idea, things that look more bird-like, C.M. Cosman's Avi Sapiens, for example, you know, as things like that. This is a less anthropocentric way of imagining it. So in that sense, they started their conversation kind of. But I think also, you know, what they wanted to do is provoke this kind of slightly more existential question. Is the human form inevitable, right? Is there something in the way evolution selects that would have favored binocular vision and bipedal and opposable thumbs and all the rest of kind of whatever else happened? Would there be something like us, or is the human bow plan the result of a series of random processes? You know, that's a question with profound implications for religion and for kind of one's personal philosophy. When we think about its success, I think we should judge it in terms of its success in igniting those questions. And the fact, as you say, that we're still here talking about it demonstrates that it did very well there.
Yeah, for sure. So let's have a discussion more on the model itself. So you said that they were already working on Ctenonicosaurus. So obviously, if you're going to do it, you've started a serious model on that. You might as well do your not so no hang on you might as well do your speculative work on the same model whilst you're on that. I can see why, but I just don't understand, like, why it had to be a dinosaur, not any other kind of dinosaur that would fit this thought experiment. It could have been any of them, couldn't it?
So my understanding is that the idea was that Ctenonicosaurus was quite highly encephalized, or was understood by Russell to have been quite highly encephalized compared to other dinosaurs. So he did quite a lot of work on kind of relative dinosaur intelligence. So
by that you mean it's got a bigger brain?
Yes, brain to body size ratio is kind of Russell's thing in the late 70s, and so I think what gets his attention, and he's not the only one, by the way. Carl Sagan is involved in this story too, if you want a tangent. But what gets him involved, what gets him interested, is this idea that, okay, this thing was smart. In, you know, like we would now say, like bird smart, like corvid smart, which doesn't need to imply a human intelligence or sentience, obviously. But, you know, we come back to Jurassic Park, don't we, and the problem-solving raptors. This is part of that story. So I think then he's saying, okay, is this intelligence that they had potential? Or is it its own thing, I suppose?
Okay, so you said that it was constructed in the museum. What's it physically actually made of? and how big is it, and how long did it take to make, all of those questions about it.
They were building it for about, they were building the Stenonicosaurus from the very beginning of the project to the end, I think it's about 2 years. Obviously they're working on other stuff as well, but it's a big project. One of the things they are doing, so they are life-size, which in the case of the Stenonicosaurus is kind of, I don't have the measurements in front of me, but kind of like the dinosauroid comes, is maybe like chest height. So small humanoid. The Stenonicosaurus is kind of, I guess, again, comparable to a Jurassic Park Velociraptor, in other words, a Utahraptor, but Deinonychus, but kind of a bit more angular, a bit more slender. It was, we would now say, shrink wrapped. Didn't have enough soft tissue, so looking a little more slight than those things. But the models were meant to be life size, and one of the reasons for that is that one of the ways that Russell calculated the brain size was to do water displacement. So they built the models and sunk them, and then measured the water to kind of get an exact sense of the volumes that were involved. So the modeling process is again considered to be part of the research process.
Okay. So if we look at the model of as a living organism, and I'm aware that we've not really spoken about what it looks like, we've listed a couple of its characteristics, but what can we say about it, about the dinosauroid, based off of its inherent characteristics?
Do you mean just in terms of like what it looks like?
Like if we said it was an animal, a real living animal, what would it be doing? How would it be living? What does it look like? What does it do?
So interestingly, Russell and Seguin do not take on the question of how it would have lived really at all in their 1982 paper. In some later art that Ellie Kish did for the project, which was never published until Darren Nash and I managed to get some of it attached to this paper that we did, shows them living in kind of tribal communities and kind of having a sort of, I suppose, quote unquote, caveman relationship with each other, caveman society. So what you're imagining, if I'm asking you to imagine this, you know, what you can't get away from is the easiest thing to do if you want to describe this thing to someone who's never seen it is say, think of an alien, right? because what it is it's smaller, slightly larger head, but binocular vision, more reptilian eyes, larger eyes than a human, no teeth, more sort of a beak with a soft palate. And kind of these long, quite slender limbs, quite slight frame, and they were sort of green rather than gray, but you know, the language, the visual language of the Roswell gray is kind of in there. And this is the other kind of unspoken thing about the dinosauroid, is that there's this whole separate thing about extraterrestrial intelligence going on, because one of the other implications of the question that the dinosaur asks is, if the human bowel plan is inevitable here, then it massively improves the chances, doesn't it, that something like a human could evolve somewhere else in the universe?
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a whole extra existential wing of the question, which perhaps I won't go into now, but I will mention as we go past that Russell was intensely interested in it, consulted for SETI, for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, on the basis of his expertise in this area, and wrote lots of letters about it to all kinds of different people. And he attributed the success of the dinosauroid to the film E.T., by the way. He thought it kind of made things relatable. So it looks like an alien, and I suspect that's not a coincidence.
Okay, we were taking a close look at the kinds of languages used by Russell and the other people who publish. But what about that of the art that was produced? You just mentioned another image, and hopefully we'll be able to have this to show people as well. Yeah. But with the dinosauroids in caves as kind of like a primitive, kind of almost human-like kind of society. But they would have had, you know, like 65 million years leading to that point. Why is it that, you know, they're not as advanced as humans were at that point? Why choose to show them as something primitive as opposed to something advanced? The dinosaurs in the stars?
That's a great question. I should say, you know, Russell himself says very little about this. I suspect he had answers to this question, but across the 1980s, it was so clear that the scientific community had not received his idea well, that he just kind of stops talking about it. And we don't get to the point where we're thinking about their society properly. So what we do have is we have a maquette and a few paintings surviving from Ellie Kish, who I keep mentioning. They're wonderful just as works of art. I think they're amazing. The most interesting one by Miles, hopefully you can get this for people to look at, shows a quote-unquote modern dinosauroid lecturer pointing with a stick at a picture of a dinosauroid like cave society. And the modern lecturer is wearing a sort of something that looks a bit like a kind of turtleneck, kind of red turtleneck. And is standing, you can just see around the edge in what is clearly something that looks like a natural history museum, evidently lecturing on their primitive forebears in the dinosauroid Stone Age. So that's a moment that imagines multiple stages of this dinosauroid evolution, I suppose, if you want to call it that. But also, I think, it exists as a parody of our reality, as alternate history always does. And something that Darren Nash noticed about this picture that I had missed was that Carl Sagan had a crimson polo neck almost exactly the same as the one that the dinosauroid science lecturer is wearing in that picture. And when you put a picture of the two of them next to each other, as Darren has many times in his talks, it's pretty difficult to imagine that Kish wasn't doing that on purpose. So it's also, then we're back in satire, right? And it becomes just a commentary on our world and less of an imagination of theirs. I think the most important thing to say about that image, though, is that it was never, you know, that was never part of the original idea. In the original paper, they stay very focused on the biology. They don't ask these kinds of social questions about the dinosauroids.
Okay, so how far is the dinosaur, is the dinosauroid removed from dinosaur biology? And I guess, is it more dinosaur, is it more human, or is it more alien, or a combination thereof?
I mean, I think it simply depends on where you're standing, the answer to that question. I mean, the science answer to that question, you know, is he does think about how you get that skeleton from A to B and what would be different and what would have to happen differently. But obviously also, I imagine a scientist would say you have to force a lot of your own bias in order to make that happen. On the human end of it, you know, there are clearly a lot of ways in which it's not human. It's definitely in the uncanny valley. You would jump if you met one, but it's human enough. I think in terms of its cultural success, they did very well with the eyes, because it has these huge kind of wistful eyes, which I think we all kind of respond to in some way. And so they're relatable, you know, and this, the model is kind of striding and gazing into the future. So there is a kind of thoughtful, aspirational quality to the way it's made. to the expression in particular, or what we read as expression on a face that, you know, may or may not have had expressive ability, I suppose. So yeah, how much is dinosaur, how much is human? And as to how much is alien, there are humanoid dinosaurs in science fiction for decades leading up to this, going all the way back to Pellucida, through the Silurians in Doctor Who, which come up in the 1970s for the first time, the creature from the Black Lagoon, you know, all of these kinds of things. I should say, in fairness to Russell, that Darren and I believe ourselves to have read everything in his archive which relates to the dinosauroid, and he never once mentions one of these things. So if they are influencing him, they're doing so very quietly or subconsciously, if you like. But at the same time, the wider current of ideas about, you know, what real aliens, Roswell Greys or whatever, and what science fictional aliens might look like, the similarity is difficult to overlook, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, I had wanted to know about its contemporaries. It's because it wasn't released into just like some vacant eco space of what hypothetical eco space. Like, there were all of these other things. And like you said, the creature from the Black Lagoon, as one of the few things that I have seen, is a fish from the Devonian that ended up as a humanoid, and that was done in the early 50s or something like that.
Yes.
So why is it that Russell's dinosauroid has this place in our hearts in commentary about speculative evolution, whereas some of these other things in Doctor Who, in The Creature from the Black Lagoon, why doesn't that? Is it just how serious it was done?
I think partly, yeah. I think it is, you know, it is proposed and conducted by a scientific expert as a scientific idea. And even though he stresses its provisionality, and even though a lot of other paleontologists, nearly all of them, in fact, are very anxious about it, and rightly, it has a different tone on it, but that also authenticates all the desire that's hanging around from reading these other texts that have been coming out ever since dinosaurs got big in the 19th century. And I think there's an enormous appeal there. Certainly, from my lay perspective, I find the idea irresistible. and I think that's the thing about it. It's a very catchy idea, and it remains so. You know, so just recently, Adrian Tchaikovsky published a novel called Doors of Eden. Which is a sort of alternate reality, kind of jumping between different evolutionary possibilities science fiction novel.
That sounds really good, actually.
Oh, I thoroughly recommend this book. If you don't know him, Tchaikovsky is a brilliant science fiction writer and fantasy writer, and he's very interested in kind of biological thinking, I suppose, and how different organisms would think differently. And in Doors of Eden, he kind of is proposing an ability to move between timelines in which there were different evolutionary successes. So a relatively near one has a present day populated by Neanderthal descendants as opposed to Homo sapiens. And the further back you go, you're not really going back, you're going sideways into a present day until you get all the way to a present day that is just the Ediacaran kind of soup, but kind of with more evolution on it, I suppose. It's a really interesting book and a lot of fun. But one of the timelines in there, of course, is the dinosauroid one. Except because he's got a zoology degree, Tchaikovsky is quite responsible about this and does them as birdmen in the kind of C.M. Kosman dinosauroid style. And so they are sort of feathery bipedal hunting people who they're called bird people in the book. I don't think he ever uses the word dinosauroid, but he does acknowledge Kosman and Roy just right in the acknowledgements of the book at the very end. So that's a long way of saying these ideas from this discussion that Russell kickstarted are still worth money in science fiction today and are still evidently captivating writers and audiences. And I think that's because of their cool alien factor, but also of the kind of the line they give us to these kind of very big existential questions about our species and ourselves.
Okay, so their reception, I think we can guess has been very different between the public and the paleontological community. So how well was each received?
So it's just one of those ideas that won't go away. And I think, most of the paleontologists I've talked to about it have kind of shared your exhaustion with it, I think, because it's done the rounds so many times. And people won't stop talking about it. And I think that's because it's an infectious idea. And I think that's because it's a very successful pop culture idea. Its success in pop culture is immediate and vast. And it just keeps popping up. In science, obviously, it vanishes quite quickly. In a later book, Russell revealed that one of his colleagues wrote anonymously to him at the time with the line, anyone can write science fiction if they wish, you know, with the kind of the subtext there being, but you shouldn't have done this as science. So it's, I think, paleontologists at the time and since, the problem is less with the idea itself than with the prospect of encouraging the crazies or making it appear as if the science is all a guessing game of this kind. Also kind of wrapped up in fantasy and assumption and tiger's leaps. Because then and now, there's a need, I think, to distance the science from work that could make anybody think that there was a lack of exactness or rigor or an ability to speak truth about the past in what paleontology tells us based on kind of more concrete evidence. So that's my explanation for it, I suppose. There are loads of other ways of reading it, though, and I think probably every paleontologist has a slightly different relationship with it. But I have never met a paleontologist who didn't have an opinion about it and who wasn't ready to talk with me about it for some time. So I think what it really is is an idea that's successful in that sense. You know, Thomas Huxley wrote about writes about how an ugly truth can kill a beautiful idea. I'm misquoting that, but that's kind of the essence. So you can have this really elegant hypothesis about life, and then, you know, just some irritating single thing can just wipe it all away and replace it with something that doesn't feel as good. And I think some of that is going on in the dinosaur as well. Sorry, I'm a mincemeat of that question. Sorry.
So where did the dinosauroid find its home? Which group of people did it most resonate with? Did it ever prove a real hit anywhere?
Directly and indirectly. So it turns up a lot in documentaries, in children's encyclopedias, nonfiction, lay nonfiction. It doesn't really have an afterlife in technical literature that I'm aware of. Although it, you know, occasionally is mentioned even there. I mentioned strange internet communities and the dinosauroid, you know, is sometimes seen moving in the same circles as lizard people and creationists. Dinosaurs are all fake, you know, those kinds of communities. And so, you know, it's to be found over there, but it's also, you know, it has its champions. I know Richard Dawkins said some words in support of it in 2009. Simon Conway Morris appeared with one in a 2007 episode of Horizon. So it's around. I think my favorite way of answering this question as to the current status of the dinosauroid kind of within the scientific community is to tell you where the original model now is, which is it's in the Canadian Museum of Nature where it was built, but it's not in the collection. It doesn't have an accession number and it's not on public display. It's in the coffee room.
Really?
Yes. And
is it in a glass case or is it just out there?
It's just out. I believe it gets seasonal dress, so it gets like a Santa hat at Christmas and stuff. It's named Herman. I have not been able to understand why. And there it is, you know, absolutely part of a scientific space, but not part of the official story that scientific space is telling the public. And I think that is actually the single perfect way of understanding the legacy of this thing. You know, it's in the coffee room. I think that's just great.
And it'll be a conversation starter in there, I bet.
Absolutely.
So how did Russell come to view it himself?
Yeah, as I already said, this is kind of a sad bit of the story because I think that he wanted a response that was a little more, I don't want to say open-minded, because again, I don't think his aim was to convince anybody that this is the only thing that could have happened. But I suspect that he was hoping to open a bigger conversation about speculative evolution and about kind of the role of destiny in evolution. And instead, he is getting, on the one hand, kind of supportive letters from crackpots and on the other, kind of pilloried by some of his colleagues. And he continues to develop the idea for a while, but by the late 80s, early 90s, he's really stepped back from it and is at the point where he's not going to conferences anymore. And is kind of, when people bring it up, he just shuts the conversation down. He's just given up talking about it.
Is he embarrassed or is he just sick of always talking about the same thing?
I think it's probably both. I think he was made to feel embarrassed about it. He isn't at first. So as late as 1987, he's still talking about it a bit in Odyssey and Time, for example. He mentions it at the end. By the 90s, he's had enough. And you know, he's a colossal figure, not wanting to be remembered for just this one thing. And so I think he's trying to kind of get oxygen to his other publications and ideas, which were many. So I think his forced retreat from the subject is the sad thing about the tale, for me at least. Mm-hmm. I understand why it happened and I understand why he did it. But he ends up simply not wanting to talk about it. By the time he retired, I think that was his approach to the whole science. He kind of left a lot of his scientific connections behind when he retired. And wanted, I think, to keep thinking actually about the philosophical and religious side of the questions about deep time and deep space that his work had raised. And perhaps the establishment was not yet integrated enough for him to feel like he could have those conversations from within it. That is me speculating at the end there. But what is certainly true is that he was made to feel uncomfortable talking about the dinosaur and eventually he just stopped.
It's a good job I didn't invite him on. Were he still around?
Were he still around? Yeah, no. He did pass away, sadly, quite recently. So the article I keep referring to that Darren Nation and I wrote is part of a Festschrift issue for him in in the Canadian Journal of Earth Sciences. And every paper in it, except ours, pays tribute to his very impressive contribution to the science far beyond this insane idea. For Russell people listening, he's a big figure with a complex legacy. And I think he probably would be uncomfortable with how much we're discussing this, but I also think, you know, the idea deserves discussion and is important, not because of its scientific validity, but because of the questions it inspires us to ask about how science works and how we communicate science to each other and how scientific ideas take off. Like you said at the beginning, there's just so much in here to think about and to think through. And I think he gave us such a powerful conceptual tool for having that conversation. Even though I think he would probably feel ambivalent about the discussion that we're having, were he able to hear it, I hope he would also feel the force of my point that I think ultimately he has started some incredible conversations over the years and will continue to.
Yeah, intentionally or not, I think that's a wonderful legacy for his dinosauroid to have. And I expect that it will go on to inspire similar conversations, most notably in the comments section below this episode. Shameless comments plug there. But yeah, what do you think of it, audience? Let us know. It'd be really interesting to see other perspectives and opinions of this and its validity as you see it, and what you think it was trying to say, what you think a dinosaur future could have looked like. I think it's a great way to start. Using this dinosauroid is a great way to start having these conversations, and I'm hoping that this kind of conversation can pop up as a result of this interview. So
I hope so too.
Right, well, I think that is pretty much everything for this dinosauroid. I have found it absolutely fascinating to look at it from this new way of thinking, and not just from this scientific, oh, it's a load of rubbish. And now I think it's the greatest piece of paleo art that's ever been made. So it's been wonderful to have you on to talk us through it all. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall Smith. PaleoCast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the PaleoCast Gaming Network.